Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well podcast series. I'm your host, Craig Dowden, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you here today. For those of you who are return attendees and listeners to the podcast, a very warm welcome. Awesome that you took time out of your hectic schedules to join us today. And then for those of you who are new to the series, another warm welcome for you. Really, really appreciate your interest in terms of the science and practice of positive leadership. The Do Good to Lead Well podcast is now rated in the top 1.5% of podcasts globally. And that cannot happen without you. I feel so privileged to be a part of this engaged community. And as I mentioned, I couldn't think of a more amazing topic to talk about today. I've been really looking forward to this. And I know Rob's schedule is incredibly, incredibly busy. I'm going to open up the discussion with a brief bio, and I cannot do this justice. So I'm thrilled that Rob Cross can join us today. For over 20 years, he has studied the underlying networks of effective organizations and the collaborative practices of high performers. He's worked with over 300 organizations and has reached thousands of leaders from the front line to the C-suite. He has identified specific ways to cultivate vibrant, effective networks at all levels of an organization and at any career stage. He's currently a senior vice president of research for I4CP and the Edward A. Madden Professor of Global Leadership at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Rob is also the co-founder and research director of the Connected Commons, a consortium of over 150 leading organizations accelerating network research and practice. He has written over 50 articles for Harvard Business Review, Sloan Management Review, California Management Review, Academy of Management Executive, and Organizational Dynamics. His work has also been repeatedly featured in high-profile publications like Business Week, Fortune, The Financial Times, Time Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, CIO, Inc., and Fast Company. And if that wasn't enough, a couple of recent developments, The Microstress Effect has been recognized as an award-winning book by Thinkers50 and one of Harvard Business Review's Big Ideas for 2023. So without further ado, an extremely warm welcome to Rob Cross. So Rob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Gosh, thank you. And I wish I'd been recording that opening there. I keep telling my kids I do important things and it gets me nowhere.
I love it. And I know how much in demand that you are. And so I'm really excited. And as always, one of the things I appreciate, Rob, is open to your questions. So please jump in. I'll be monitoring the comment section so you have a chance to talk to a global thought leader in terms of effective networks practices, micro stress, you name it. So to get the conversation rolling, I was really intrigued by the origin story of the book in terms of how it came about. So without giving too much away, can you talk about that?
Sure. Yes. It's funny. I can point to a couple of things that have been fairly significant ideas over the course of doing this for 25, 26 years. And most often they were things I was planning to do. It was kind of paying attention to, you know, things that were emerging in different interviews or feedback from organizations that are part of the consortium. That was the case here. You know, when I apply what we do in the consortium, we go out and assess connectivity in various ways. We can map patterns of collaboration or other things that are flowing in connections with people and look at groups of 2,000, 50,000, 90,000 sometimes if we're looking at large scale cultural change programs. And we've been doing that for quite some time and getting separate performance data from organizations to really hone in on what top performers were doing in terms of how they collaborate. So everybody has collaboration as a leadership capability. You know, they may call it one firm or whatever. Everybody has it. But then they're defaulting to other things like Myers-Briggs or DISC or things like that to really hone in on what those people were doing. And so we were really focused on understanding it from the analytics and seeing kind of what these people were doing. And I was presenting the results back to the consortia. So I had about 200 companies in a room about 5 or 6 years ago. This is pre-COVID. And everybody was excited. You know, there's really hard evidence behind how these people were collaborating. We ran the analytics. I did 600 interviews, 300 women, 300 men, and a ton of really great practices, right, around what people should be thinking about in this hyper-connected time. And I remember, you know, at the end of that session, close to the end, one of the people on the back raised their hands and said, well, what about not performance, but well-being, right? What about people that are just happier and sustainable in these really intense times? And, you know, at that time, you got to remember this is 5 or 6 years ago, I just kind of groaned. It's like, was like, oh no, you know, that's not a good idea. Because I wanted to go focus on innovation. That's all the rage, you know, at that point in time was organic growth and innovation. But, you know, I always follow the lead because most of the times the things that really hit haven't been for me. And sure enough, I started doing these interviews, a very similar strategy here. We use the analytics to define the truly happy people. And by happy, I don't mean that giddy happy, right? I mean kind of high on psychological well-being, life satisfaction, thriving, resilience, all sorts of metrics that we were playing with. And did hundreds and hundreds of interviews of those people, you know, split between men and women. And it got into my soul, you know, very, very quickly. You know, I was having 90-minute discussions with people that you probably only have with 3 or 4, maybe 5 people in your lives. And it became very, very clear just the degree to which people were struggling. You know, the first 10 minutes, because these were successful people, the first 10 minutes of every conversation, life was rainbows and lollipops. You know, it was all great. And then you slowly get under the veneer in minute 30 and minute 45, minute 75, and you see the struggles that people have both professionally and personally because of the way we're so hyper-connected, right? That's what's really risen that we don't pay attention to is the degree to which these electronic communications, the flatter organizational structures, everything else like that has created opportunities for some goodness, but there's also some unintended consequences, right? And in this case, we were seeing it was the way that stress was coming at people and the magnitude of that. But then I was also super heartened, you know, by about 10% of that population that didn't progress down negatively. You know, they actually stayed high the whole time and they were kind of, you know, thriving from a performance and a personal standpoint. And so those became super interesting too, to see, you know, what's unique about what these people are doing. So that was, you know, my personal journey through it. And then, you know, as I went, I was reading, of course, all the studies on the role of connections and well-being. And it's just stunning, you know, the lack of connectivity or being clinically lonely or not having the right quality of connections in our lives. The same mortality rate as smoking 15 cigarettes a day, 26% greater likelihood of dying earlier, you know, physical impediments, mental impediments, I mean, all sorts of things. And it struck me very clearly when you see the magnitude of evidence there that we need to pay more attention to this. We need to be more intentional because we'll chase blood pressure medicines, right, or cholesterol medications down, and yet we're completely ignoring, generally speaking, things that have the exact same impact right on our physical and mental well-being. So that's what led me into it, the whole sordid journey, if you will.
Well, and thank you. Already got some great comments already about how incredible this is. And to me, again, I love the evidence-based approach to it. I love how that surfaced and really appreciate the mindful perspective in terms of, okay, so how can we unpack this? And one of the things that struck me right away, and I've shared this with clients and client organizations that I work with around the whole idea of micro stress. And right away they go, and the title as well, how little things pile up and create big problems and what to do about it. Right away they go, wow, micro stress, that's interesting. Like, what's that?
This is what evolved through the research. So we started this research geared at, you know, targeting what were the reasonable ways that relationships could have an impact on well-being. So we looked at all the models of well-being and we focused in on 4 dimensions, right, of different models of well-being: physical health, growth, personally and professionally, how we experience purpose in our lives, and how we experience resilience, right? Those were all things that there was a reasonable likelihood that effective interactions with others were going to have an impact. So we kind of parsed away financial well-being. You could make a stretch to that, but it wasn't really central to people's existence. And so that's what I was interviewing for. The very first interview I was in, just to kind of give a story on it, and then I'll describe it a little bit more, was with a life science executive in London, you know, lovely British accent, very successful woman. And I asked in the very first questions, can you tell me about a time in your life where you're becoming more physically healthy and not what you were doing, right? But what was the role of the connections around you that got you into this effort, kept you persistent in it, created a different version of you, you know, all these things. And she just kind of laughed for a second. And she said, well, Rob, I was the person in high school that dodged gym at every chance I could, right? I wanted nothing to do with physical activity. And that worked for her up until her kind of mid to late 30s, which is where we see, you know, people falling out of groups and things that keep them healthy because of professional and personal obligations. And she said she got a warning from her doctor. And she said, you know, he or she said, if you keep doing this, you're not going to enjoy your 40s that much, if at all. And so her solution to that was she started walking around a park outside of her flat in London. And because she was walking at the same time as other people, they struck up conversations, right? And this group started meeting and they walked together. And then they would walk longer walks. And then they did a charity walk and a charity run. And you flash forward 10 years to when I was talking to her, and she was picking vacation destination spots where she would, with her significant other and members of this group, run a marathon before going on vacation, right? And this was the person that was the self-described couch potato, right? Earlier. So it was a fantastic opening to the study, you know, super high energy, laughing. And what she was saying was the identity of becoming a runner, right, was what helped her push back on work on the margin. Right. So suddenly she wasn't staying for those last 5-10 emails. There were just different priorities that started to emerge. But the key to it was having that activity in a diverse group of people. And so she was spending time with an auto mechanic, a mail person, a cardiologist, a software executive, and they all saw life and challenges differently, right? She saw them at their worst. They saw her at her worst. And it created dimensionality in her life that became different than if she'd just been spending more time with life science executives. Right at the heart of it. And we saw that over, you know, hundreds of interviews, right? The more happy people, they have at least two and usually three groups outside of their profession that they're a part of. And that dimensionality really matters. But, you know, so you have to be in this interview. It's going 100 miles a minute, right? And now I'm thinking, this is fantastic. You know, I got a bunch more of these. We got a bestseller here. And then I stopped kind of halfway through about 45 minutes. And I said, well, what in the world got you in trouble? Right. Because this son is clearly smart, funny, charismatic, you know, very warm, you know, great, great individual. And yet she let her physical health deteriorate to the point that she required that kind of warning, right? That she needed to do things. And it turned out that tremendous numbers of successful people fell into that, what I call an echo chamber. And it may not be health related, it may be loss of purpose in their lives, it could be other things. And this interview that's going 100 miles a minute went down to zero, right? There was a silence, like right now almost. And she said, I don't really know. You know, and just life. And so we dug into that. And what it became clear in the last 45 minutes of this interview and then the hundreds after was that it wasn't big moments of stress that was killing her. And it wasn't a health scare, you know, a nasty client. It wasn't things like that. They may exist, but what was choking her was the accumulation of the small, right? And so these small forms of micro stress, they tend to be things that come at us through connections with others in our lives. And we tend just not to really even pay attention to it, particularly successful people. They're just small obstacles that we have to get over, right? It's sensing misalignment with a colleague and wondering, how am I going to solve that? Then the next call you're on 30 minutes later, you see a teammate that needs to be coached for the third time. You're wondering, how am I going to do that, right? Without burning out their engagement, and goes in the back of your mind. And then 10 minutes later, you get a text from a child, right? That they're upset about something and you can't tell if it's a big deal or small. Usually they're over it in 2 seconds. You worry about it for 3 or 4 hours, right? And it was that accumulation that was really crushing her, you know, because of the way that we've become so hyper-connected in both our personal and professional lives. And so we termed that micro-stress, right? Kind of small moments of stress that in their isolation are inconsequential. But when you look at the volume, pace, and diversity of them that are hitting us today, they're overwhelming what our systems are designed to react to from a stress standpoint.
Such a great insight. And it was something when I was sharing with clients, friends, colleagues about the idea that something right away is, oh, what's micro stress? And you did an amazing job of laying that out and just talking through it. Oh yeah, that it what I find is it's not surprising to me. It's one of the HBR big ideas for 2023 because it makes so much sense. Like every single person I speak with in that frame, they're like, oh yeah, there's this thing that's there. And then I love your point about it's almost the reason why it's insidious. It's small and almost like, well, it's not a big deal, yet it does have an impact on us. And we carry that along despite it not registering. I think that's such a powerful insight, Rob, through your research.
My co-author, Kieran, did a lot of work on the neuroscience aspects of it as we kind of shared different responsibilities. And that was fantastic to delve into, to really see that, you know, our minds literally don't register. We don't invoke fight or flight, right? The cortisol doesn't flood us as we would with conventional stress, but our bodies absorb it in the exact same way, right? And so most people resonate with the idea of our heads hitting the pillow, you know, these nights, and you know, you're exhausted, but you can't quite tell what just happened, right? Or kind of what's done it to you. And, you know, we even saw studies that showed that it affected, you know, all sorts of physical aspects of us and even metabolically. There's a fantastic study done that there were, you know, having subjects eat the same meal, right? Caloric intake was the same. Some subjects ate that meal without being under this form of social stress. Some subjects ate it with being under this form of social stress within 2 hours. And what they found is the subjects that were under stress, they added 104 calories to that exact same meal, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but if you add it up over a year, it was like 11 pounds, you know, metabolically, just because of this kind of stress that we don't tend to think about and register. So it's invisible, but a significant deal for people to be thinking about today, for sure.
And what what struck me too, just that idea of just thinking about, oh yeah, like if it's a big, big thing, then it's almost like mobilize. And what I found was so provocative and revealing is around, oh, there are things that just kind of are operating almost in the background, yet they are there in a big way. And then you can just really see how that can be manifest. And if it's coming in throughout the day through different relationships that matter, well, it's just going to keep having an outsized impact from how it feels in the moment. So I love that perspective. We already have a question, so I'm not surprised, from Leanne, who says, Rob, great discussion. Can you comment on the difference in connectivity through a screen versus in person in terms of its impact on our health and loneliness?
It's a fantastic question. So one of the interesting things that we're seeing is that our youngest generation is the most connected, right? If you look at all the modalities, the younger generation is the most connected out there. Yet, if you also look at the studies on loneliness, they're the loneliest. It's not the elderly population. It's this youngest generation. And I think it's a product of two things that are causing problems. There's a lot of things. We could spend the whole hour on the difference between face-to-face and virtual, for sure. But just a couple of, you know, big ones. One is it is causing a deterioration in skills that allow people to develop authentic connections, without a doubt. Like what the stress results are showing is it's not just COVID. COVID has spiked it a little bit, but this has been happening for about 12 years. So it really is a product of all these things we've done to delayer organizations, hyper-connect each other, right? Inside and outside organizations. And what that's also done is hurt our ability to be authentically present with others. So, you know, the Gallup studies are showing, others are showing that most of us have evolved to either not having anybody. About a third of the population doesn't have anybody that they can talk to about things that are challenging for them. And those that do tend to turn to two kinds of people, you know, and that turns to be their spouse or their parents. So it's putting more pressure on those relationships versus, you know, how it would have been diffused, you know, in earlier times. So I think, you know, that's one of the problems that I think reasonably we can say is a product, right, of the virtual modalities that's happening. I mean, the positives to them too, for sure, without a doubt. And then I think the second thing that's really insidious, and this is less about screen time and face-to-face, but is the social comparison that happens as a product of all these ways that especially our younger generation is connected. You know, it's funny, I did a session for about 80 CFOs about 2 weeks ago, I think it was. And I remember this one CFO came up to me and he said, you know, the younger generation doesn't experience stress. And I said, really? and you know, kind of opened the conversation. He said, yeah, they don't take the work as seriously as we did, right? And to some degree, he's right. And I actually value that, you know, and seeing it with my children and others, that there's a better perspective, probably. And I said, yeah, that's probably true. But what they do have is this social comparison where they're constantly thinking about, you know, what do my friends have? Who are my friends with? And it creates an enormous burden of stress and anxiety that we haven't had in the past. And then we could go on down a whole bunch of things about how trust is formed more naturally in face-to-face contexts. I mean, a lot of other things behind that. So I think it's a fantastic question. I'm just kind of scratching the surface with a few ideas there.
No, well, and thank you. And I agree. And Karen wrote, wow, mic drop moment for me, social comparison. Hadn't even thought of that in terms of the pressure. So love that point.
Can I just, you know, pick on that for a second? Because one of the more fascinating things with my successful people is almost all of them would describe, these are all top performers, right? From top organizations, right? So, you know, if they're struggling, imagine what the rest is feeling was kind of the approach, you know, going into it. And almost all of them described some point in their career where they took what I came to call one step too far, right? So they would come out of school, they would get a good job, they would get an apartment in a place they want, and they'd buy their first home, they would start a family, they would say, I've got to have my family in a better home. And then eventually the kids would hit school and they'd have to have their kids in the right schools and the right, you know, bigger home, right? And it was all this provider role that was driving this incremental steps. And eventually they would take what I called one step too far, where it was one, you know, mortgage too large or two train stops too far out of the city. And it was the final straw that kind of collapsed, you know, all the things that were keeping them whole, the basketball leagues, other things like that. And the interesting thing to me is that is a social comparison process. You know, it's not just the younger kids. And it's actually a noble thing. It's materialism, but not in the sense that we think of as I have to have a Ferrari, right? It's just this, I have to be a good provider, taken to such a degree that it was one of the things that almost everybody I spoke with went through some stretches in their life where they ended up making decisions that had a dramatic impact on their life by kind of one reach too far. They'd been able to absorb everything right up until that last one that required some retooling in different ways.
Well, and again, got a comment from Anna saying, wow, provider absolutely rings true. And I love, Rob, your point as well around there's a noble purpose behind it. Right. So what I'm looking to do is contribute positively to the people that I care about. And yet I love also that it's a bridge too far, a stop too far. It's overextension. Really great.
And what you could see, you know, I would get to some of these interviews and some of them were, again, super successful people that had allowed life to revolve completely around direct family and their profession, right? That was it. And those were the stories that really struggled, you know, as they got deep into life. It was the people, again, if I had one or two ideas, I'll try to sink two or three times for the group, is have at least two and usually three groups outside of your profession that you're an authentic part of. You know, it has a huge deal to do with perspective we have in life, what we think matters. I mean, just a lot of important things come from just doing that alone.
And another great takeaway for me from the book is why I really appreciated how you and your co-author also amplified diverse networks and diversity of people within. So rather than a singularity, and there's lots of evidence around the power of diversity.
Right.
And I really appreciated how in this context and in a world filled with micro stresses, how essential that is. And I also appreciate the counterbalancing where, you know, I can share my diverse perspective with others and I can learn from that. And so we're all figuring this out together as a broader community.
Right. And that, you know, the challenge is that's one of the things that COVID did have an impact on. So legitimately, you know, for example, going into COVID, people used to complain to me pre-COVID, oh gosh, Rob, you know, I've got 8 1-hour meetings right in a day. I can't get anything done. And I'm overwhelmed with, you know, collaborative demands until I get home and I can work. And then somebody going through COVID came up with a great idea that instead of 1-hour meetings, let's do 30 or 25 minute meetings. And now we're all saddled with not 8 1-hour meetings, but 16, 30 minute meetings, and we're exhausted with it. And I'm obviously exaggerating a little bit, but you know, we're more intense in those shorter intervals. We're moving across them, which is more cognitively stressful than we realize a lot of times. And we end the day with a to-do list, you know, based on 16, not 8 meetings. And it's a product of kind of, you know, how we're interacting that has legitimately risen the stress level, right? That's around us, the opportunities for these small moments of stress to come at us. But at the exact same time, in terms of what we're talking about, the social distancing aspects of COVID also pulled us out of these groups that were kind of giving us dimensionality You know, people stepped out of their book clubs, their dinner groups, their choruses, other things. A lot of people aren't getting back in, you know, and so we talk a lot about strategies for that. If that's happened, there come, you know, very specific things we see that help people kind of slingshot back in different ways.
Well, and have another question again, the quick, fast and furious question, without surprise. Dave said, love Leanne's question around connectivity and want to build on that in terms of what are your thoughts, Rob, around return to office and the impacts that you've seen in your research and also that hyperconnectivity and collaboration overload?
Yeah. It was interesting when we went into COVID and when we, you know, were like 3 weeks in and we thought, oh my gosh, what if this goes to 4 weeks or something? I was asked to participate in different surveys, right? Like with the big survey vendors, you know, that this is going to massive amounts of people to say, you know, different aspects of how are you collaborating because of what I do. And one of the questions they allowed me to slip in was just an open-ended question at the end that said, you know, how are you experiencing COVID, right? Which was your reality like? And normally you put these open-ended questions into big surveys like that and nobody fills them out. You get 5 out of 10,000, right? This time we were getting hundreds of pages of really thoughtful commentary back, but it took two completely different forms, right? The first sets that I would read would be something like, oh my gosh, thank gosh for COVID, right? And not for the disease, but oh my gosh, I don't have a 2.5 hour commute. All of a sudden I'm talking to my significant others, my children like me, I'm sleeping more, I'm eating healthy. Thank the Lord this happened, right? It's changed my life. And I think, okay, this is a positive thing. And I get to the next one and it would say, oh my gosh, what happened to all my time? Like the commute was the only time I had to think. Now I've got meetings constantly, please get me back in the office. And it was about 50-50, you know, in that as we were processing it. What struck me really clearly is for that second group of people, it was that they'd given up control of the situation, right? They'd allowed other people's idea of fun to dictate kind of what they did and how they did it. And that's kind of what, you know, we saw through COVID is that we have more ability to shape what we do and who we do it with in any time in human history. But too many of us tend to give that control up quickly. We fall into other people's expectations versus putting our own expectations into how things get done. And I worry that that's going to be a problem in the return to office, right? Mm-hmm. And what we can use our analytics and different work we've done to say, here are the packages of people you want to be bringing back at the right time so that you're actually getting the right interactions happening there. But that's not what a lot of people are doing. It tends to be these 2-3 day mandates. And so suddenly you've allowed people where you've actually ramped up the work expectations because of what I just said, with the smaller fragmented meetings and other things. And now we're going to tack that commute back on in ways that may or may not be compensated for by energized interactions in the workplace, right? A lot of times people showing up and the people they need to work with aren't there. So it's an interesting challenge. I can say the exemplars in my consortium, this is a different body of work we've had going on return to office. They're really focusing. We know that people want three things out of these interactions in this return. One is interactions that create energy and purpose about what it means to be a part of that organization. Interactions that create serendipity and innovation, right, or problem solving, and interactions that create development and growth. And so what I'm seeing is that if you know that, then you can start working with your leaders to structure that face-to-face time like gold for those three things. You don't just go back and start running the same meetings again. You focus in on how do I architect differently, right, and shift some to the virtual space, some to face-to-face. And, you know, we can see the places that are taking that seriously, they're doing well, you know, through it. There is a balance that's kind of emerging out there.
And on my side as well, just hearing about, to your point, people going back to the office and no one else is there or their colleagues aren't there, or it's very haphazard. There doesn't seem to be a purpose to it. And then that creates more frustration, more stress, more, and it's like, so why are we doing this? And so I love how you've outlined those three core things. And again, for those listening, it's such a powerful rallying cry around, okay, so how do we maximize these three conditions? And one of the first micro stresses that you touch on in the book really resonated with me. And I hear about this so often. And I'm going to quote from the book where you say, where there's a misalignment between collaborators on their roles or priorities. It's time and time, like different roles, different priorities. There's lots of, so what can we do here to manage that much more effectively?
You know, as I went through these interviews, that idea of misalignment that wasn't handled early and directly tended to be some of people's worst career experiences. You know, if it continued to spiral in a way that people couldn't bring it back together to get the project or the work done, you know, within the constraints they had or done at all, it just tended to really be problematic. The problem is, of course, you know, and then very, again, positive things about our shifts towards agile ways of working. But one of the problems is leaders are not aware of the collaborative costs. And so they're throwing teams at everything. And what we're seeing is people are generally on 4, 5, 6 teams today, right? They may have one that they're accountable for, but 4 or 5 others that they're a part of. And that means that people show up to efforts with different levels of commitment, right? And if you, you know, happen to have people that either have their functional leader pulling them in different directions or prioritizing different things, or they just care about different aspects of the work because you didn't really kind of settle under the purpose, the why, right, of the work well in the beginning, it creates tremendous amounts of scenarios where people agree in the room and then go off and pull in, you know, slightly different directions. And so, you know, what we were seeing a lot of in terms of practices, and we've, you know, published this in the book, very specific antidotes to each of the micro stresses, as well as put on an app that people should look at the Apple store. It's called the Micro Stress Effect app. It's free for everybody. Is, you know, getting clarity, like ending your meetings 10 minutes early, you know, recapping kind of what you're doing, checking in early with people to set the expectation that we need to kind of come in, come back, you know, with what we've committed to, and other devices like that, right, to ensure that there was kind of commitment. What I would see a lot of times is it wasn't the big misses that was problematic. It was the accumulation of small misses that really kind of got people because they were all reasonable, right? But if 4 people miss by 5% on your project, that's a 20% impact to you, right? And you're kind of stuck either working through the night and pulling yourself out of things that keep you whole or under-delivering, you know, and both are bad things from a stress standpoint, obviously. So those were some of the high-level solutions. And there's more templates and things like that in the book as well.
No, well, and one of the things, and thank you for the answer, very helpful. One of the things I really enjoyed about the book was the thoughtful reflection exercises that were there, where you could walk through and with each of the different micro stresses you identified, the 14, there were some really powerful exercises that you can break down and they're concrete. So rather than being an abstract, okay, like interested in what you're proposing, yet when it comes to being actionable, I'm not sure. You really get into, oh, okay, this is what I need to answer, and this is what I need to do with that answer. Can you talk a little bit about those exercises? I just love that orientation.
I am blessed to be part of this consortium, you know, where these are all top companies, and if they're spending time, you know, with these ideas, they're not looking for theory, right, in an academic in a closet by themselves studying small things. So that was why people resonate with us, you know, is because you do 600 interviews and you're going to get the central things that are really hitting people. And then, you know, I would dive down into, okay, what do you do about it? Like in the past, when this has happened, what's been successful for you? How have you done it? How have you structured it? And it would take, you know, obviously different forms, right? So for misalignment, it's about securing alignment early. It's about checking in and creating social accountabilities in the group. So you're, you know, kind of distribution lists, your meeting formats, kind of have people in the beginning say, here's what I did, didn't do. It just kind of starts to create an accountability. It was also setting expectations with their leaders early on, that here are the resources that we need. A lot of times that was what was driving the misalignment is people would be asked to do something. They would say, absolutely sure, because they want to help, but they hadn't really thought through and their leaders hadn't thought through the resources needed to get it done. And so suddenly, you know, they're in a position where people aren't giving the time because they haven't been given the time and it causes problems, right? And so there was templates in there to kind of think a little bit about that, you know, and pausing and ensuring commitment to that over time. But throughout, that was, you know, one of the really important things is with each of these micro stressors is to be really precise on kind of what you can do, right? And that there is the ability to shape this in different ways.
Well, no, and it's one of the many things I really appreciated about the book, not just the evidence-based foundation upon which it's built, also in terms of the tangible takeaways that you can address each of the core ideas. I've got another question, as I said, not surprised, these will keep coming in fast and furious. So DC says, love the discussion about priorities. I find that our senior leadership team changes priorities on a dime. how can I raise this issue effectively with them?
Yeah, that is one of the micro stresses of the 14. You know, we talk about there's five that have to do with drains to capacity, and they kind of hurt our ability to get work done. There's five that have to do with things that just hit us emotionally and drain our emotional energy, right, that we bring into work. And then four that are really about small chips at our identity, right? Things that are kind of slowly pushing us to be somebody we didn't start out to be, right? Either personally, in terms of how you are as a parent, a sibling, whatever it may be, or professionally. And those kind of unexpected shifts and expectations from stakeholders was one of the more common ones, right? And what it tended to do was take the form of changes in the what of the work, changes in the performance expectations, right? Either the quality or the magnitude or the timeliness of it, or just leaders that emotionally showed up differently, right? From point A to point B, and you didn't quite know, you know, what you were getting each time. A lot of people have that, you know, and they immediately think, oh man, that stinks, right? I don't like that. What we often forget is the secondary effect of these and how these kind of micro stresses cascade as well, because then you're usually stuck in this position of having to go protect your team a little bit, right? Or re-enroll them in a different direction now that other things, you know, may not matter, or maybe timelines have shifted, whatever it is. Or a lot of times I'd hear stories of people saying, you know, to get the first trajectory of work done, I had to go negotiate help from five people, right? And I gave help to them, right? Now, suddenly their help to me is not useful, but I'm still stuck helping them, and I got to go find new people to help. And so there's, you know, kind of secondary cascading effects on that. What we're finding works really well with this one and some of the others, particularly in the drains capacity categories, we've done videos on all of these, and you can see that on my website. They're kind of 7 to 8 minute videos on the micro stress, what people do for each of these. And we've then packaged these and the tools under these nudges that we send, and we kind of cascade these in 2 week nudges to leaders in a certain population, right? So on a Monday morning, we're targeting first level leaders and managers, because if we can reduce the cascading of stress at that point, then we know we can have a big impact culturally out there. And with the, you know, the shifts in expectations, the nudge goes to the leader and then to their leader that same morning. And it starts a 30-minute conversation around, is this going on? What's the effect of it? But it's not the individual having to start the conversation, right? They're looking at a video and they're reflecting on, here's three ways that this may be going on, right? And it starts a lighthearted conversation around, we just need to be mindful, right? Things are going to shift undoubtedly, but we can be mindful about the effect of it when we really see the bullwhip impact. And then, you know, there's a tool with that that the leader takes into their team, and they then are talking about it, because it's easy for us to recognize the shifts that are put on us. What we oftentimes don't think much about is the stress we cause, right? Because we're doing this too. And inevitably the stress we cause unnecessarily boomerangs back to us in different forms a lot of times. And then it stimulates a conversation at the end of the 2 weeks amongst groups of four or five of those leaders to say, here's what's working. And so if we're right with things like this, it's the idea of putting the nudge out there, a tool, and then situating it in conversations that start to shift the behavior, right, in the context there is one way that we've seen be pretty successful there.
And I'm so glad you incorporated that. Because for me, again, one of the great takeaways and one of the brilliant insights that I found in the book was around, well, yes, it's so easy for us to identify when others are creating micro stresses for us. And then it's maybe I want to turn the mirror around at myself and ask the same, how might I be creating micro stresses for other people? I think that's so important.
Yeah. A lot of times with, you know, webinar formats, I'll pull, right? And I'll have people say, okay, which one or two of these are driving you crazy? And then, you know, the poll will come up and I'll talk about, you know, whoever is nominated the most. And then I'll turn it just like that. And I'll say, okay, now what are you causing? You know, and you can feel people's reaction, like, oh no, I don't want to think about that. But the amazing thing is the polls are almost identical, right? You know, the stress that we experience, we tend to pass on. And so what you want to think about is how do you kind of find points to stop that cycle, right, of stress that's being created there. One of the things that most people find really helpful that we've done with the book is in chapter 5, we have a kind of a template that we're focused on to say on the column, the first column, here's the 14 micro stresses. And then across the top, we have the common sources of these micro stress, right? So
your boss, your colleagues, your teammates, your loved ones, you know, people that these things create. And I'll have people go through that table, you know, in three ways. And I'll say, first go through and say, where are two or three of these that are systemic enough in your life that you should do something about it and that you should be addressing? And the reason that that really matters is the negative interactions have 3 to 5 times the impact of the positive on us. It's a removal of the negative. If you're not focusing on that, if you're just doing meditation and other things, which are great things, but if you're just persisting through the system you've let build around you versus shaping it, you're leaving a lot of really good stuff on the table, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the leverage. And then 3 to 5, you're causing, right? Or 2 to 3, 5, you're causing to kind of think about, okay, what's boomeranging back on me? And then 2, 3, or 4 that you just need to rise above. You know, a lot of our experience of stress is because we've gotten down in the weeds on something that in the scope of life just doesn't matter. If we back away and really think about what we want, it doesn't make sense to push that child one more time on something in the scope of things, right? And we find that to be a really effective way of moving this from the, oh my gosh, I'm in a sea of this stuff, I can't do anything about it, to really getting down to say, you know what, there's actually some pretty tactical things that can have a pretty quick and big impact on me by paying attention to those three ideas.
Well, and I really appreciate how you know, as you say, create that chart and then go through it with different lenses. Okay, so what's a mission critical area for me? Something where I need to give this some intervention, some attention, and then also flipping it around and going, all right, now how might I, what are the things that I'm doing? Bring some balance. And then as you just said, Rob, you know, okay, and then what are some areas where I can just rise above, let this go? Yeah. And again, it's so empowering. I've got another question coming through. Stephen really enjoyed the observation about checking yourself first. So was curious, in your research, are there common micro stresses that people cause to others that they tend to be less aware of? I guess maybe around, it's almost like a well-intentioned thing gone awry.
So the bigger things that we would tend to see are the shifts in expectations, like that cascades, right? People are just reacting and they're justifying their behaviors, you know, as reacting to others out there. One of the others we'd see is in the emotional category, some of the biggest micro stresses are actually not coming at us through negative relationships or things that drive us crazy. Some of our most impactful micro stresses are coming at us through people we love and care about. And what we could see in that is a lot of times the anxiety created by trying to take care of others and worrying about them, whether it's the team and making sure they get the right bonus or the right developmental opportunities, or it's a child and worrying about their, you know, life progression, or it's an aging parent. We put enormous expectations on ourselves, a lot of times to overdo, that actually takes the capability of those people from solving their own problems away. And so again, it's like that provider role, you know, it's coming from a good place, but it starts to create, you know, more of a dependency than actual abilities to solve the problem. So those are two, you know, that come to mind that a lot of times you don't hear people thinking about. And they oftentimes don't think about, you know, the positive relationships and the way they create stress. In my own world, I had my daughter's a huge source of purpose, right, for me, and a wonderful young woman, 24 years old, a huge, great source of perspective in life, great source of humor. You know, she calls me Baldy all the time, and, you know, we just laugh about a ton of different things. But she is also my biggest micro stressor out there. You know, the constant source of just back to churning around. Is she okay? She's applying to med school. Is she going to get in? Right. And these things. And one of the things we discovered is that she was a huge source of secondhand stress for me. Right. And so she had been a very high level tennis player kind of going through juniors. And because we were from a small market, it was always us at these tournaments nationally, just kind of working through it and figuring it out. And she just got used to coming to me whenever anything went wrong, right? This is annoying, or Baldy this, Baldy that. And the problem was that persisted, right? Through college and applying to med school. And until we discovered one night that she doesn't care about all this stuff she's texting me on, right? It's just a knee-jerk reaction that she's sending on. And but for me, I experience it in 3 or 4 hours of worry, not fight or flight worry, but just, you know, is she going to be okay, right? Low-grade worry. And we just kind of jokingly discovered this one night over a glass of wine. I said, well, it doesn't matter to you. Don't pass it on to me, right? So the important part of that to me is what I see people have great success on is if they focus on the interactions and the relationship. Because just removing that stuff that didn't matter to her, so I'm not paying attention to stuff that does matter. I'm there in a heartbeat on that. Stuff that didn't matter to her has had a profound impact on my quality of life. And it's actually improved the relationship. right? And if you start looking at things this way, with the micro stresses or the sources of purpose or resilience, and think about not the relationship, but the interactions that are happening within them, it opens up so many possibilities to think about how to live differently. And that was really one of the most inspiring things from the happier people in this work.
And it strikes me in these conversations I'm privileged to have, the importance of framing the issue. And you just talked about, so rather than looking at a relationship, you look at the interactions within. And now that just the perspective that that provides, and now the actionable insights as well in terms of, so, okay, looking at these things and then having a collaborative conversation, because these relationships matter.
You know, it happens on the positive side too, as well. Like if you ask hundreds and hundreds of people how they got through difficult stretches in their lives, and you focus not on what they did. Like, I think that's the myth that's been created by so many well-intentioned articles around that we own resilience, right? And there's truth to that, right? We are individually, we own resilience for sure. But if you ask people not what they did, but how they relied on others to get through that difficult stretch, and I would hear stories ranging from, I didn't get the promotion that weren't that big a deal, to my spouse died from pancreatic cancer, right? And I was left with three young children. And what you find is that there are eight really predictable ways that we tend to fall back on others that make getting through difficult stretches much easier if we build, you know, the relationships. And so I find that that same notion, right, of paying attention to the interactions with an eye to removing the negatives, right, is one piece. But then with an eye to also saying, well, gosh, I don't have, you know, for me, laughter is a key source of resilience. For other people, it's empathy. For some people, it's perspective in a situation. For some, it's needing people to help them see the path forward, right? People that have been in this parenting situation, been in this role, we have different needs. But once you start to look at those things and say, you know what, I don't get enough of that, then there are different ways to get it. You know, one of my favorite interviews was the head of neurosurgery in one of the leading hospitals in the world, right? A very austere, brilliant man. And he had gone through some interviews and a program we ran there, and came away with the idea that he'd gotten too unidimensional. Right? His life was just about, you know, medicine and family, right? Direct family. That's a noble thing, right? But loss of having other aspects of life had made everything seem like it fell and rose on work. And so his solution to that was that he went to play music. He played guitar in high school. So he went to a music store, bought a guitar. As he walked back out, he saw a flyer to join a band, and he did. He called him up. And I didn't know any of this, right? But I got an email like 4 or 5 months later, and the subject line was, Rob, I've joined a rock band. And then he went in to kind of describe, you know, how this effort to add dimensionality in his life led him to be playing guitar in a band with 20-year-olds, right? And he said, I'm having the time of my life. These are not my best friends. They never will be. But I have an activity that's creating separation for me from work in that space that I value. And I'm getting very different perspectives on life, right, that I never had when I was hanging around with neuroscientists out there. And that's a really common strategy for people. Like if you're sitting here on the call and you're saying, you know what, I've fallen out of these groups that kept me whole. One of the common strategies is to reach back to a passion from a past and use that to slingshot yourself into a new group. It's a very easy way to kind of get dimensionality back, and it creates resilience, right? Through these small moments of interaction out there.
Well, Grant, great ideas, suggestions, and again, how we can learn from people who have been successful in terms of dealing with their micro stresses. I have another question from Tina. We've got less than 10 minutes to go, so time has flown. Tina was wondering, loving this discussion, were there any surprising findings in your research, things that you found difficult to assess?
Yeah, I don't know that it was surprising to me outside of the degree to which people are struggling. I think that's what got in my soul. Is, you know, I had people, you know, very successful people choking up in these interviews. And I think that was the thing that probably really took me off guard, was the magnitude of the issue, because we don't see it, right? The first 10 minutes of those interviews were rainbows and lollipops. It was only when you got deeper down that you saw the degree to which people that, you know, on many levels were successful was struggling. I will say, you know, I practice what I preach. I'm very serious about being part of a recycling group, right? I don't go cycle by myself. I could, and I like that because I'm an introvert by nature, but I cycle in the group, and it's brought me in contact with, you know, people that have become very good friends, a mailman, an IT executive, other people that have created dimensionality for me there. I play tennis. I'm part of a church group. You know what I mean? I'm very serious about kind of leaning into dimensionality right, in life that way. And I found a profound impact for me in the way I see things, right? It's just has introduced kind of perspective in situations. And so, you know, if I guess I had any big surprise, it's probably the degree to which that was so much easier. And I wish I'd done it a lot earlier to kind of, you know, build that into life and the impact that it had.
And I appreciate the observation they made, Rob, as well, in terms of the extent to which successful, quote unquote, people, you know, high performing, high functioning executives, and then the extent to which underneath there can be some struggle and profound struggle. It's really interesting for me hosting this podcast, as well as different CEO mastermind forums where people come together and share. And yes, it's amazing what goes on underneath. And I really appreciate your point. And at the heart of it as well, reflecting on my own experience, it is, it's about the relationships. It's the connections. It's the micro stresses that come from the people that we care about most that are critical. And one final question before we close. You do talk about values conflict and how that can impact micro stress. So can you take a moment just to, you know, because I think that's really powerful. I love that you included that, the identity piece.
And so for us, that would take the form of the excessive revenue pressures, right? Pushing people to oversell in situations beyond what they thought was right, or excessive cost pressures, where suddenly they're treating suppliers or employees in ways that they just didn't think this is how I'm going to show up, or with physicians, right? Many of them didn't anticipate enduring medical school and the cost of all that to be in programs where they're treating patients as they have to now, right? So processed versus being in a relationship with them. And so you saw that in different ways. There were ways that people just became different versions of themselves, you know, over time. And the biggest point that I would see this happening through careers, right, we'd be asking about, you know, longitudinally how this happened, was in transitional points, right? And so what would happen a lot of times is people would take a job, maybe in another city, because the job looked great. It was another $100,000, whatever it was, right? But they underestimated the impact of all the connections that they'd built up in one place to their well-being, you know, in different ways, or even their success professionally. And they would move into this new area. And it doesn't even have to be a move, right? It could just be taking a new role, accepting a promotion, transitioning to a different project, right? But the mindset for about 90% of the people for most of those transitions, they would go back and say to their significant others, you're not going to see me for 6 months, right? Or I'm going to be busy for 6 months, and then I'll get back into life, right? It's just going to be a short time thing. And what would happen most often is they would slowly, incrementally become smaller versions of themselves, right? They'd fall out of maybe a tennis group because suddenly they didn't have the skills anymore to keep in that group, or they would fall out of other book clubs or whatever it may be. And so to me, one of the more interesting things was the 10%ers, that they would go into those transitions, not all of them, but many of them, with a very different mindset. They would say, no, this is the ideal point for me to shape other people's expectations versus me falling into their idea of fun, right? And they would actually, you know, be more intentional about shaping the work coming into it. They think about how do I become a broader version of myself, right, through this versus becoming in a more reactive posture. And those were the people that did, you know, much better, right, over time. And it was never the big things, right, on this point. It wasn't the happy people weren't defined by writing a concerto, right, or hiking the Himalayas. It was the small moments lived more intentionally with others that they tended to be better at thinking about and building into their life day in and day out.
Well, and thank you. And I couldn't think of a more perfect answer to close kind of the formal part of our conversation, because that's something that just is throughout this amazing book. And again, I encourage everyone to pick it up because there's so many insights personally, professionally there. It's that the impact of the smaller things and how they can unnoticed just have tremendous consequence. And also how in the same vein, how if we are more intentional and we're more proactive, we take more of a shaping role as opposed to sitting back. There's so much that's at our disposal. You were talking about earlier about medications that we pursue. And then for us, relationships, they're right there. There are small steps that we can take to build them, foster them, and it positively impacts us, positively impacts our communities.
Yeah. I'll give you, you know, maybe as one closing thought on that, just to, you know, a very pragmatic thing. And it was a very profound interview for me. It was with a Silicon Valley executive. She had been a runner all her life. Happens to be another running story. They all weren't. But she'd come out of one of the top schools, right? And it was the chief strategy officer and head of the venture fund for one of the best software companies out there. So very successful, right? And when we got into the interview, she said, you know, Rob, I blew it the first 20 years of my life by letting society tell me what running was good for. And by that, she meant that she would run for personal best time. And if she didn't get a personal best time every single year, it was a bad year for running. And, you know, logically, you know, that's not going to happen, right? Age catches up, demands of work and life, you know, catch up. But it was structuring her time, right? She'd get up earlier, right? To stretch more, to do yoga, to do weight training, all things that were pulling her away from family and friends and other things by virtue of the way she was doing it. And she said she woke up one day and said, I realized I want to be running with my daughter, her best friend and a parent. And it evolved to this community in her community of parents and children that were running to stay physically fit. So she was using the same activity. And this is the key thing for me in this idea. It was taking the same activity, the same amount of time, maybe not running as fast, but pivoting it in a way that says, what are the interactions that are going to make me feel more purposeful in my life? And this happened to be interactions outside of work, but the same idea applies inside. And I find everybody can do that. We can all relook at certain things and say, how do I do slight pivots, right? That tended to be the success driver for these people more than anything else.
And what I love what you're sharing, Rob, it's the same activity. And it's just kind of making this shift and then infusing it with more intentionality, purpose. Okay, so what can I do? And so it's not a transform, let's change everything. It's that so things that are currently there that we can do and are within our control. And so thank you so, so much. This has been,
thank you.
I have so many comments about love the passion, love the insights. For me, it resonates as well. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you've just been slammed with commitments. It's a pleasure to have you on. Any final words before we close our discussion today?
Just to thank you and appreciation for yourself doing this and people in the audience. It's a treat for me, a privilege to be able to share some of the things we learned.
Well, pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us, and can't wait to see you on a future episode of Do Good to Lead Well. Until then, bye for now. Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.